This is a special showcase episode of the Round Table Podcast. 20 minutes with Alastair Stewart. Hello, literary alchemists. I'm Dave Robison.
And I'm Brian Humphrey.
And you are listening to a special showcase episode of the Roundtable Podcast entitled 20 Minutes With.
20 Minutes With is a segment in which Dave and I are privileged to share the microphone with some truly talented people, and this week will certainly be a great one. Dave, tell us who we have.
Oh, Brian, I'm a Twitter, and I don't mean in the I'm in the 140 characters of time sense. This is awesome. Yeah. Our guests. See, this is an example of shit that's going to end up on the editing room floor.
Right.
Our guest this week is a freelance writer. He's a keyboard mercenary. He's an ink slinger for hire. In addition to his own eloquent blog, he's written for Sci-Fi Now, Comic Heroes, Neo, How It Works, The Guardian, and SFX, where he wrangles the blockbuster crew there. He is the editor of the Hub e-zine, blazing a trail through the science fiction frontier with new fiction reviews and editorials. His storytelling prowess has earned him a coveted seat at the adventure designers table for, get this, the Doctor Who role-playing game. Oh yeah, baby.
Brilliant.
And he is the host and voice of the escape artist horror podcast Pseudopod. In short, our guest is the man we all want to be. Alastair Stewart, welcome to the Roundtable Podcast.
Hello, gentlemen. How are you doing?
We are doing outstandingly well. How's things on your end?
Pretty good. Pretty good.
Excellent. Did I cover all the bases on that? I want to make sure I fully represented the full spectrum of your gloriosity.
That's gloriosity is now my officially new favorite word. Yeah, that's everything pretty much.
Outstanding. Outstanding. Well, let's not mince any words about this. Let's get into the 20 minutes with Alastair Stewart. And Alastair, I'm going to start off. No doubt you have read countless books and manuscripts in your role as editor and reviewer and gatekeeper. And I kind of have a two-part question. When you are reading a books or a submitted manuscript or something along those lines, what is it about that story that affirms to you that it is a good story in terms of the writer's craft and work with the story? And what makes you cringe when you run across it? So what do you wish writers would do more of, and what would you be perfectly happy to never see again in a manuscript?
What an excellent question. To answer the first half, probably the thing which I am drawn to most of all is a strong, confident, authorial voice. And I've done right, an authorial voice will transcend an awful lot of the dull stuff, you know. I'm trying to think of a couple of really good examples. The obvious one would be somebody like China Meville. I have a very interesting relationship with China Meville's work. I love it, but I am less fond of the fact that there are a lot of people working very hard on trying to be him. Just that feeling of, for want of a better word, swagger, style. There is a tone that an author gets in their work when they're in complete control of it. And it's really hard to get there. I mean, my own fiction is, and I will digress briefly, the writing group I'm part of went through a phase where my friend Steve would, halfway through reading a piece of my work that I'd taken along, would hold up one of two postcards. And then these postcards would either say, "Very nice imagery, but where's the plot?" Or, "What's the bad guy, Al?" And that's kind of the authorial voice taken to the ultimate extreme. You just go, "No, this, and throw some stuff in there as well." But if you can hit that kind of Goldilocks zone, if you can hit that point where you've got absolute control of your story and your building materials, but it's still you, then that really makes me sit up and pay all kinds of attention. The best example I can think of, and this is a dreadful stereotype and I do apologize, there's a beautiful quote about David Mamet, which is runs something like, "He writes exactly like, and at the same time, nothing whatsoever like people talk."
Yes, very much so.
That sense of style, that ability to assemble words in a way only you know, is something which really grabs my attention. To answer the second half of your question, let me see. During my time slush wrangling, I have...
Slush wrangling? Really?
Slush wrangling. I have borne witness to a 27,000-word period necrophiliac incestuous horror piece.
Oh, God.
Submitted to a market which had a strict 9,000-word word limit. And there was this beautiful, chatty email on the front. Look, I'm really sorry, guys. I know this is vastly over. But I really like this piece, and I'd love it if you could take a look at it. And it was Frank Capra. You know, I was reading this, imagining Jimmy Stewart on the other end going, well, I've worked really hard on this. I will read this for you. And 19,000 words in, I was just going, I need a shower for my brain.
And some Clorox, some bleach.
Exactly. Yeah. That's probably the kind of worst example. The stuff which I just key off badly is humorless. There is a lot of desperate need, certainly in science fiction and certainly in English science fiction. By the way, if you listen very carefully, that sound is, you can hear in the distance, is a lot of doors being slammed on me forever as I say that, which is very, very concerned with being serious, middle class, and very focused on important issues and not actually having any fun.
Yes.
And you do something like that, and I just go, well, this is a bit like really average pasta. It's well made because it's pasta, but I kind of want some cake now. So that really is the thing which gets me, this the kind of desperate need to cram worthiness into a story which doesn't necessarily have it.
So the moral of the story is, don't take yourself too seriously. And when you're sitting down to write, sit confidently and have fun.
Exactly. Robert Rodriguez once said that he was a filmmaker the moment he had business cards made up which said filmmaker. And that level of confidence is something which writers need. By the way, just before I'm put on a pedestal, it's a level of confidence a lot of the time I don't have. And very few writers I know do. But you have to when you lay a story out metaphorically, you have to walk into a room and go, eyes here, look at this, let's go.
Yep, absolutely. In fact, I'm currently working on an article for Mythic Scribes on finding the writer's voice.
And, excellent.
And may I quote you on that as a source? Excellent. Brian, you had a question, I think.
Yeah, kind of to follow up. With that, we're talking about writer's voice. There are a lot of stories that that you read or that I've looked at that don't seem to stay with me for very long. And yet, when listening to things like Pseudopod and Escape Pod and all of these other pieces, a lot of the stories that show up on there tend to linger in my head for the next week or month or sometimes the rest of what my life has been to this point. So what would you say, even past writer's voice, maybe into plot or for you as a writer, is that it thing that will stick with someone and hang on and work its way into their flesh to really sort of influence their thoughts for the next month or so, as opposed to just being a dull story? What is it that writers that you have seen have put into their works that stay with you?
Themselves is the short answer.
Okay. It comes back to that voice then.
Yeah. Okay. There is a tremendous bravery inherent in fiction writing, I feel, because, to roll out page one of the book of hoary old writer cliches, you write what you know. But the section of that that's written in invisible ink, which no one can really see, is you write what you know, but you have to be prepared for it to really, really hurt. There are a couple of pieces which Pseudopod has put up, which I find it difficult to get through because they speak to personal experience I've had, and my perception is that they come from personal experience of author. To go back to China Meville for a moment, one of my touchstone books is Looking for Jake and Other Stories, the anthology of short fiction he put out. And there is a story in that which, because I'm horribly unprepared, I can't for the life of me remember the title of, about a very erudite, very nice older man who is widowed and who buys a stained glass window frame because he likes it and it's an unusual colour. And what becomes apparent over the course of the story is that the London on the other side of the window frame is not his London. This story stays with me because he reminds me of my dad. Now, I'm delighted to say that my mum's still very much alive, but there is a commonality of experience that runs through that where, rightly or wrongly, my perception is that Meville based this gentleman on his father, and he's a lot like my father. So there's an emotional short circuit that takes place. Now, from the writer's point of view, and from my own relatively limited experience, writing, for want of a better word, emotionally, writing from personal experience, it's very easy to tell when you're doing it right. So when you're not actually having very much fun. There is a piece which I haven't had published, which is based entirely around what it was like to live on the Isle of Man growing up and to go back there 10 years later and realize that I was 10 years larger. For those of you who don't know, which is probably most of the rest of the population of the planet, the Isle of Man is a 30 by 40 kilometer long island sat perfectly between England and Ireland in the middle of the Irish Sea. We are frequently what the English weather people stand in front of during weather forecasts. It was once memorably described as 170,000 alcoholics clinging to a rock.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
That paints a grim picture.
It was huge fun to grow up there, but, you know, to borrow the old joke, any time someone asks me why I left, I tend to answer with, I found the airport. But I got to a point where I was kind of 10, 12 years out from living there, and I went back. I will never forget driving along the road across the mountaintop in the center of the island and looking out of the car, and I could see the ocean through every single window. And that realization that this, my universe as a child was tiny, was ultimately what powered this story, and inevitably the sense of unfinished business you get if you're a member of a small island community and you leave. And I'm incredibly proud of that story. And I'm completely sabotaging my point by pointing out that no one bought it, but I like it, so there.
Right. Well, and that's the bottom line right there. Ultimately, I think the ultimate a writer needs to evolve and develop an objectivity to their work. But first and foremost, my God, if you don't love your work, how can you expect anyone else to?
Exactly.
Right.
We'll be back with more of our conversation with Alastair Stewart after this brief promotional break.
Wake up, go to work, work, come home, eat dinner, rot your brain out, go to bed, lather, rinse, repeat. Are you tired of an old humdrum life? Tired of things that just weigh you down and depress you? Wouldn't you rather just focus on things that are awesome? Tune into Nutty Bites. Find out what's awesome. Nutty Bites. NIMLAS.org/blog.
And now let's get back to our showcase episode with Alastair Stewart. So I had no idea about your background on the Isle of Man. That must have been incredibly isolating. Did you have a rich fantasy life growing up?
It's the reason why I write. you really had two choices growing up on the Isle of Man. You got very outdoorsy very fast, or you became an immense nerd. I, let's be tactful, did not become outdoorsy. I've watched out most of the local video shop. I attended the local cinema so regularly that the line was often stopped because the lady behind the till was telling me about what was out this week and whether or not it was any good.
The foundations of your critical analysis skills there.
Oh, God, yes. I hit the ground running with that age 15. You know, other people were getting girlfriends and boyfriends. I was going, ooh, Speed's actually three action movies in one, isn't it? This is going to be important at some point. It breeds a hardy individualism. You make your own fun. And that's served me quite well in later life. It's also taken my legs out from under me a couple of times. But
how so?
It's a fun place. You're really arrogant. Manx people are really, really arrogant, and we're often also very polite and softly spoken, but there is this element of the Manx national character. And did you see how I was able to use Manx and national in the same sentence?
very nicely done. Thank you.
Where fundamentally you operate off the assumption that everyone from larger islands is wrong. To give you an example, I was one of a graduating class of 30, and I am one of two who has not gone back. Every single one of us scattered to the four winds to go to university. Every single one of us got jobs over here. It is now me and my friend Richard, who is a doctor in geology and spent most of his time on the Falklands. So Hodge has even technically swapped out the Isle of Man for other smaller islands. You feel the pull a lot because it's a small, tight-knit community, and even if there are people there you hate, part of you wants to go back and glower at them for the next 40 years.
Well, and that's kind of an interesting metaphor for a lot of the very polarized publishing community that's been evolving recently, with all of the EPUBs and the traditional pubs and the various genre factions that have evolved. And YA, oh my God, let's talk about YA. Do you find yourself uniquely equipped to navigate these shark-infested and very volatile waters with a background and like you have?
Yeah, really, for two reasons. Firstly, because I quite like stories that are good, and I'm not really that bothered what format they come in or what audience they're aimed at. I mean, I'm sitting in my bedroom at the moment surrounded by ridiculous amounts of stuff, including a V mask and the Draw Henry Rollins Some New Tattoos sign that my girlfriend got me for Christmas. But I'm surrounded by books which range from, The Wind in the Willows. I have a copy of The Wind in the Willows, which my mother gave me when I was 10. Which is one of my most treasured possessions, and which I reread regularly, up to the kind of 4,000-page Peter F. Hamilton, you can use this to beat a whale to death type stuff. And you go with what's good, really. And what's good is almost what speaks to you. And I think one of the problems... By the way, gentlemen, for those of you keeping time, it's taken me just under 16 minutes to decide this, that I know exactly how to fix the genre fiction community. If only everyone would listen to me. That, believe it or not, that's actually kind of a record.
That's awesome. Please share. We'd love to be the ones to break that news to the community.
You can all go home now. Alice has figured it out.
All done.
One of the problems, I think, is that everyone clings to these little life rafts. You know, traditional publishing, with the notable exception of the evil genius Mr. Harris, who you'll have on quite soon,
yes,
tends to just go, no, we must be over here and do this. And e-publishing, I think, e-publishing and podcasting, secretly, quite a lot of podcasters and e-publishers like to pretend they're the crew of the Serenity from Firefly. You know, because there is a maverick ideology to it. Because, you know, anyone can podcast badly. It's very difficult to podcast well. And there's a lot of, you know, the print publication people go, oh, well, you guys just do stuff. And the e-publication people go, yeah, well, you're old. And there's some dreadful kind of West Side Story dance fight in the middle of it. And what everyone seems to forget is fundamentally you go where stuff's good. And it doesn't matter what the delivery medium is, and it doesn't matter, you know, what area the author was aiming for. I mean, there is a huge, huge Twilight backlash, and I will not defend those books, don't worry. But Stephanie Meyer is capable of good work. People whose opinions I trust have said very nice things about the two Alien Invasion novels she's cranked out. One of my favorite movies, to go to a slightly different medium, is the hilariously dreadful 1984 Tobe Hooper science fiction thing, Life Force. And I come back to that thing over and over again. You go with what works, you go with what speaks to you, and you shouldn't do that on the basis of, well, I'm dressed like those guys, so I should go over there. At least in my opinion.
No, I completely agree. Right. Yeah. There's a lot of contention and a lot of hair bristling and posturing. But you're right. I think the analogy of the podcast and ebook crew being the rebels, being the sharks, or the jets, depending on how far you want to extend the metaphor, is really drawing attention away from the quality of the work that's being put out. And the fact that wherever that quality is where the readers will go. Exactly. It's just very hard to with the ebook, it's very hard to isolate what is good and what isn't. I think that's going to be one of the defining elements and metrics of this next generation is where do people go to figure out which incredibly convenient EPUB book to download?
That's exactly it. It's not about, or rather, it's not just about whether it's good. It's about how easily you can find it.
Yeah. To go off on a slightly different tack, I mentioned this yesterday, and I'll say it again. I listen to Pseudopod, Alistair, as much for your commentary as for the stories. And that ability to extract and embody a theme is that you do at the end of each, and sometimes before each story, is I think invaluable to a writer, whether they're writing fiction or nonfiction. I was wondering if you could deconstruct your mental and emotional process for identifying those themes, and then how do you evolve that very unique expression of what you discover there?
Oh, good Lord, gentlemen, this is going to get ugly.
It's okay, I've got my plastic smock on, so let's get down to it.
I can tell you the point where my style began, to begin with. And there is a good chance that this might not be something which either of you recognize, or one of you will go, God, really? early 1990s, there was a TV show called Midnight Caller.
Yes, The Nighthawk. Ah! The Nighthawk, yes.
Yes. Starring Gary Cole, a man whose hair I coveted for a very long time.
Who didn't?
Exactly. The basic premise of this, for any of your listeners who haven't seen it, was the traditional early 90s angst of the main character is a police officer who murders his partner by mistake, bottoms out, has a nervous breakdown, and because this is what happens in TV shows, is recruited to host a late night TV talk show. I can just hear people going, dude, you talk about horror. Get to the point. The thing which hooked into young, overweight, not particularly happy Alistair's mind was the closing monologue. And every single week, the show, which of course in the early 90s was all about issues, would have a closing monologue, which was essentially an excuse for Gary Cole, one of the great unrecognized actors of his generation, to just monologue for half an hour, for kind of 5, 10, 15 minutes. That concept, that idea of here's a thing, here's the 5 minutes at the end of it where the host explains what's just gone on and talks about how he's felt about it, is the thing which really lies at the heart of my approach to Pseudopod. The thing which sits next to that is complete brutal emotional honesty. I've had an interesting 5 or 6 years, for a wide variety of sections of my life have changed, and changed drastically. It's not something I'm going to bore any of your listeners with, but I have found myself on a couple of points basically having to re-examine very nearly everything. And there are two ways that you can do that when you have to rebuild. And the first is that you just go, and now everything is fine. And the second is that you sit down and you make a list of all the stuff that's broken, and you figure out how to fix it. I'm most of the way through figuring out how to fix the broken stuff. And one of the ways which I've been able to do that is to communicate, to talk about it. I have huge problems with my weight. I weigh about 319 pounds now. You wouldn't look at me, I don't think, and go, that's a 319-pound dude. But I am. I'm built tall, and I'm built broad, and I like pie quite a lot. You know, I'm the son of two parents who were both single parents from a period where England was quite poor, so food equaled love. And that tied into my nerdery and everything else. So I'm carrying some extra poundage. And the way which I dealt with that, the way which I continue to deal with it, is by talking about it. Because I am an incredible believer in the power of words. Words control and define and throw a wall around huge, terrifying, nebulous concepts. And that's why I do what I do with horror, because horror is all about the loss of control. Horror is all about the point where you realize the calls are coming from inside the room. You know, the fence has been down for the last hour and a half, that kind of thing. And I am a low-level adrenaline junkie. I love very little more than staring directly into the face of something deeply and profoundly unpleasant and going, you really need to cut your nostril hairs. And Pseudopod gives me a perfect opportunity to do that. And so what I find myself doing is I will speak about stuff in the stories that has spoken to me. And in doing that, I'll hopefully refocus on the story and I'll talk about something from my past and contextualize it a little bit more. And the Michael Marshall Smith story we ran a couple of weeks ago.
Which one was that?
I believe it's called This Is Now. It's a beautiful little piece. It's about the area in the center of America that is quietly fenced off because something else lives there. And it's about the night where five people from a small American town went over the fence and they all came back. And that's kind of the problem.
Oh, God.
It's a beautiful piece because, and I ended up talking an awful lot about the Bruce Springsteen song Glory Days in connection with it, because it captures in amber that brief shining point in your adolescence where you're immortal, and you're only immortal when you don't know that you are. And the actual horror in the piece is much less from the dreadful thing that sits in the middle of the American countryside, and far more from the realization that you're not 18 anymore. And coming from a small island community, part of me is still rather horrified I'm not 18 anymore. Although I did have a mullet at that point, and that I do have to be thankful for being long, long in the past.
Do we have pictures? Are there pictures somewhere, anywhere,
they
please?
They have been burnt, all of And that's really my approach. I hesitate to say confessional, but what I try and do is use the story as a tool to talk about what it's evoked in me, and to use what it's evoked in me as a tool to talk about the story.
Outstanding. I want to. Brian and I mentioned in our pre-show episodes, episode 0 and 0.5, that a part of this whole podcast experience and the Roundtable podcast is incredibly self-serving. and I just wanted to share. While you were describing that, I just had an epiphany about both my writing and the writing that I've seen of others. Some people, and I'm looking at myself in the mirror, use their writing, fiction in particular, as a wall, as a defense, as a way to put up something cool that you don't necessarily believe yourself to be.
Yeah.
And that fiction is rank. That fiction reeks of that fear and that defensiveness, not out and out right in the words, but anybody who appreciates good fiction is going to look at that and go, this doesn't ring true. And the fact that instead of making it a defense, making it therapy, making it a brutal and, as you will point out, sometimes painful exploration of who and what you are, and putting that out there in the fiction, that honesty tints everything in gold.
It does.
So thank you. Wow, that was huge for me. Brian, I hope you got something.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I'm silent because I'm taking notes. even though this is being recorded, I'm like, I need this in the next 20 minutes. So
yeah.
No, that's fabulous.
Did you have a question?
Yeah, well, it changes gears so much, I'm like afraid to go into it. But
wonderful. Really?
It was something that kind of hit me because, you know, we mentioned your Doctor Who role-playing game gig. And so one of the things that holds me back when I decided to try my hand at like a genre that I feel that I haven't read enough canonical examples of is the fear that everybody knows more than I do about it. And so if I, you know, if I write a story, I'm going to have 1,000 people that you know, come up to me and say, hey, you totally got this wrong. And this element, you know, is out of it. And for example, comic books, right? They're all being made into movies now. And I grew up on a couple comic books, mostly Wolverine and Ghost Rider. And so when the first Ghost Rider movie came out, I was horrified at what they did to it.
Weren't we all?
Yeah, well, they did better with the second one, but I just like it was the only time that I felt personally affronted, and you know, and when you have fans who hang on to every detail of the original so fervently that they freak out if you change the hair color, how do you approach something like a Doctor Who role playing game? You know, how do you write for something that will inevitably have such technically savvy and perfection demanding fans?
I am trying to basically work off three principles. The first is to speak to your thing of, you know, being worried that, you don't know enough about it. Mm-hmm. There are two things you can do for a gig like that, or for writing in general, if you're worried that you don't know enough about it. And again, this is kind of Book of Horror or Cliches, page two. Read a lot. And if you don't read a lot, we have never in the history of human civilization had a better run of serial TV drama. I am one of the five or six people on Earth who goes, yes, I know, every time Twitter goes, The Wire is the greatest TV program ever made. And I always hear it in that type of voice. But it is. And I kind of hate myself for saying that, because it's so fantastically well-structured and well-formatted. I mean, you have things like that. You have things like the BBC version of Sherlock. You have sizable portions of the Doctor Who reboot. You have, I mean, again, I'm just looking at my shelves, and, you know, this season one of Mad Men, sitting next to Sons of Anarchy, Masters of Horror, and Oh My Goddess, the anime series, and The West Wing, and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. If you can't read a lot, and there is this weird thing where a lot of people's attention spans have dropped a lot because information is so instant and ubiquitous these days, watch. Watch and watch and watch and watch and watch, and be prepared to ape someone's style, because you'll do that for about 2-3 months, then you'll incorporate it and you'll start turning it into your own. In terms of fans, to kind of go specific on the Doctor Who thing, I mostly just try and focus on the fact that I've been hired to do it and they haven't.
Right.
Which is incredibly arrogant. But
very empowering.
Yeah.
Yeah,
because I've pitched my ideas and the company's gone, yes, those will do very nicely. And the simple fact that I've pitched them, let alone the fact that I've written them, puts me in the top 0.5 percentile. Mm-hmm. If you write a story, that puts you in the top 1%. If you submit it anywhere, like I frequently don't, that puts you in the top 0.5. If you get paid for fiction, if you get paid to write a book, you know, you are literally the best of the best of the best. Dreadful 90s action movies should be made about you.
Yeah.
But that's really it. You know, you can worry about the audience. And by the way, I, you know, my girlfriend is, as we speak, you know, a couple, you know, when you put this episode out, laughing and clapping and pointing at her car stereo as I say this. If you write what you want, if you write what you enjoy, it will fit and coalesce with what you are being told to write about, and it will come across. Okay. It's really that simple. Worry about you, worry about the piece, worry about the market later and the fans all the way after that.
Right.
Yes. Yes. Gentlemen, I would love to continue this for hours on end, but I can see that the clock has ticked down. And as Brian and I have found, the 20 minutes always goes by far too quickly.
And it just gets longer and longer every time we do it.
Yeah, I'm gonna do a little editing, but yeah, it does. It really does. Yeah. So Alistair, thank you so much for taking the time and sharing your insights, your perceptions, and some of your history. It's been a pleasure and an honor. Brian, anything to add to that before we wrap up?
That's exactly how I feel, and I think it's I'm a little bit starstruck because I've been listening to Pseudopod for so long and sending things in, and I know that you don't necessarily have anything to do with the selection process, and so that's a good thing, because I get very kind rejections from them, but it's been a extreme pleasure, so thank you very much for sharing your time.
Thank you.
Awesome. All right, friends, stay tuned. On Tuesday, after this episode drops, we'll actually have Alistair's workshop episode, where we'll get to turn some of his sensibilities loose on a poor and unsuspecting guest writer. Yes, it'll be lovely. Until then, remember, ideas are cheap, folks. Get down, get to writing. What's the word, Brian?
Go right.
Go right. Absolutely.
Yeah, go right.
We'll see you guys Tuesday. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
This episode is copyrighted 2012 by the Roundtable Podcast and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share Alike license. That means don't sell it, but you can share it all you like. And you can even use pieces of it in your own derivative work, as long as you attribute us as the source and release the work under the same licensing terms. Theme music composed and performed by the talented Hepcats of Brotown, Gary Gold, David LaBruyere, Billy Nobel, and Matt O'Donnell. If you'd like to be a guest writer or guest host, or learn more about the Roundtable Podcast, please visit our website at www.roundtablepodcast.com or visit our Facebook page at facebook.com/roundtablepodcast. Our Twitter tag is at writerspodcast, or just send us an email at thetable@roundtablepodcast.com. Thanks for listening.